Hello, everyone. Welcome to Computer Science E7. Today, we're going to be talking a little bit more about Photoshop. But of course, before we do that, I thought we would just quickly review some of the material from last week. Specifically, we spent the vast majority of the time last week talking about histograms and the different types of histograms that exist. And some of the primary ones that we learned about eventually were the luminosity histogram, the colors, which is the combination of all the color channels, and also the RGB, which is pretty much just an average of all of the color channels. And each of these have a specific and different use for depending on the situation. They all show us, they show us different amounts of information, some that might be interesting and useful for some photos, and others that frankly may not be. And so being able to understand what which one to use in a given situation is going to be advantageous. So when we were talking about luminosity, recall that this was actually measuring the apparent brightness of the pixels in an image. And the apparent brightness is governed by that luminosity function that we talked about, where green has the most prominence. So green is worth 60% of the brightness that we see, and red is worth about 30%, and blue is worth about 10%. And with all of these in mind, if you have a bright green pixel, for example, it's going to appear brighter to us than a bright blue pixel, as you can see here. Like the portions here in this image that appear to be brighter than the rest are, in fact, the green ones. And so the luminosity histograms uses this luminosity function to determine which pixels are how bright, depending on how we view them, and it uses that to graph the histogram itself. And what's interesting about this is that you can have pixels that are a complete solid color, like completely solid green, completely solid blue, but unless you know what you're looking at, it's not going to be apparent that you have these what could be blown out color channels. In other words, that you have some color in an image that's so bright it's overwhelming that particular pixel, and you might be losing data within it. And so we might have then, for very highly saturated images that have, you know, very heavy amounts of single colors, we would see something that actually looks sort of compressed like this, where we might have individual spikes at each of these brightness levels for the corresponding red, green, and blue brightness per the luminosity function. But for the most part, this is not really all that useful for this particular type of image, just because it's not really telling us much about what's going on with the color itself. And on the other hand, RGB, well, luminosity is, it's not, I'm not saying this because luminosity is therefore a useless histogram. It's just that for certain types of images like this one, which is very heavily saturated with, you know, very heavy amounts of single colors, then it's less useful than perhaps the other type of histogram, RGB, where it does become a bit more apparent that we are actually causing some clipping in specific color channels, because we can actually see that there are some images, or rather there are some pixels that are so bright that they are at their essentially full brightness value. And again, this brightness is not luminance, it's not how we perceive the brightness, but it's the value itself. So in other words, if we have a blue value that's at 255, if you recall what this means, it means that pixel has a full complement of blue within it, then we are going to see that pixel is counted in this far upper area, on the far right area, indicating that we might be losing some data. And so what I'm talking about when I say losing some data is photos that might look like this, where you take a photo of a flower, and flowers tend to have very heavily saturated colors. And so when you take a photo of a flower that has this saturated color, you run the risk, even if you properly expose it, you run the risk of overblowing one of the color channels within it. And in this case, we're at high risk for losing data in the red color channel, because these flowers are so heavily red that what ends up happening is that we lose some of the data that might exist within it. So if you just look at this photo now, you don't really notice that there's a problem. But if we were to zoom in and really pay attention to some of the details within these flowers, you can see that there's portions in the petals where we just lose information, where it's just so completely bright red that there's no information within it. It just appears to be this solid mass of red color, whereas there might actually be some texture within this flower. So then using this, you might have to look at both histograms, frankly, to try to determine the best way to be able to take this photo. And specifically, you have to weigh the difference between taking a properly exposed photo, in this case, because you have such a heavily saturated color, you have to weigh that against making sure that you don't blow out one of these color channels. And so if we took this photo, yes, it looks like it is properly exposed just based on our its overall appearance, but if we take a look at the RGB histogram, we actually see that we have caused a small amount of clipping in this in the red color channel, or at least this histogram doesn't tell us which channel has been clipped. It just indicates to us that some channel has been clipped, and generally you can see that when you have these very strongly saturated colors like this red here, you'd be able to infer from that you might have caused some clipping there. So we try to discuss some ways of correcting this. It's not an easy thing to fix, unfortunately. You can try to underexpose it. Of course, then your exposure suffers, but then later in software you can fix it. In your camera, you can try turning down the saturation so that the colors don't pop quite as much in the photo, but then you'd be able to preserve the detail, and then later on, again in software, you could perhaps bring the contrast up a little bit more, the saturation up a little bit more to regain some of the pop of the original scene and actually make a conscious decision about what details you might want to lose in that case. You might do something fancy like add some additional light elsewhere. And this one would be pretty tough because this is pretty uniform. But if you were taking a photo of just a single flower, for example, you might consider adding some additional light to the background so that everything else sort of forces you to underexpose the photo as a whole and therefore try to get less clipping in the picture itself. Now, but this actually raises an interesting thing that we've been talking about, we've been implying it for a long time, and that is that these cameras, these sensors, actually have a fixed set of or a fixed range of light that it can detect. And we've said this explicitly, and below this range, it's going to appear to be completely dark, and above this range, it's going to appear to be completely white, or in the case of a color individual color channel clipping, it's going to appear to be just that solid color. And this range actually has a name to it, and we actually call it dynamic range. And dynamic range is actually pretty important in general. It is why the dynamic range of a camera is why I was unable to take a successful picture in this case, because the dynamic range of the scene far exceeded the dynamic range that the camera was capable of capturing. The dynamic range is basically just the range of light, of brightness within this scene or that the sensor itself can capture. So in the very bright regions, for example, that might have a certain number of stops brighter than inside of this bridge, and this might be some relatively large amount, like, I don't know, 10 stops or 12 stops or some relatively large distance like that, whereas many cameras cannot capture such a wide dynamic range of light available in the scene. So if we were actually here in this scene and we were looking at it, it would appear to be a bit different to our eyes than to the sensor of a camera. And of course, to understand that, we have to understand a little bit of the biology of the eye, and that is that, frankly, our eyes and our brains make photography very, very difficult for us. And we've seen this mentioned a couple of times before, and we're going to see it again. It's even more important when we talk about color in some upcoming week. But our eyes and our brains essentially deceive us in a variety of ways that make it a little bit more difficult to be able to determine or to try to make a conscious effort to figure out what a camera is going to be doing in a particular scene. And so pointing out what our eyes do allows us to understand what might be going on and help us to counteract against that particular thing. So for our eye, everything is relative. There's not really a true black or a true white. Things just appear to be relatively black or relatively white compared to other things. It's the eyes are essentially contrast detectors. They detect the difference in contrast between different things. So, for example, if you look at a very heavily contrasted scene, maybe you put a sheet of white paper right next to a sheet of black paper, our eyes detect that. It's a difference in contrast. And this happens automatically. We detect contrast between colors. We detect contrast between brightness of a scene, of whatever it is that we're looking at. And our eyes, of course, change dynamically based on the lighting conditions of a scene. So right now, the room's a little bit darker, and so the iris of our eyes might open a little bit so that we can let in a little bit more light. And beyond this, I mean, it's even a little bit more complex than this as well. The actual cells within our eye also make changes, literal changes to themselves, so that they will be able to detect different quantities of light. They may get used to a certain quantity of light, and they will try to shut themselves off so that you don't actually see that amount of light anymore. That's why, just as an example, if whenever you're looking at somebody's taking a picture of you and they use flash, and you can see like the residue of the flash for a few seconds afterwards, that is our eyes counteracting against that bright flash for a few moments after that had actually occurred. So, and this happens even in the color realm. If you stare at one specific color for far too long, our eyes actually get used to that color, so to speak, and we actually, when we look away from that color, we actually notice that we see the inverse of that color. And we'll talk more about this again in the color lecture, when there's a lot of really interesting and really fun optical illusions that you will be able to see about color. But for all of these reasons, our eyes do play tricks on us. And so we actually can have our eyes actually have a dynamic range as well that we're capable of capturing. So a range of light within the scene that our eyes would be able to view. So if we have, for example, a range of 2:1, that just means that something is twice as bright as something else. And obviously our eyes can actually capture a lot more than that. Just to give you an idea, 30 stops, a 30-stop range is about 1 billion to 1. So 1 billion times the brightness of something else, that's about a 30-stop difference. And you can think of that as being the darkest night to the brightest day. That's about the change that's about 30 stops worth of change in light. And again, you might say, well, 30 stops, that doesn't sound like very much, but recall that every stop means a doubling in the amount of light, in the number of photons. So very, very quickly do we start getting more and more and more photons that make up this difference. So 1 billion times the amount of light is about a 30-stop difference. And our eyes, the instantaneous dynamic range of our eye, looking at something in the center of our vision, and we're not adjusting for it, we're just right then, right at that moment that we are viewing that object, we can actually get about 13 stops of dynamic range in our eye. And this is in a bright day. So in the bright day, we can actually view a range of about 10,000 to 1. So something that's 10,000 times brighter than something else will be able to detect that difference. But beyond that, it all sort of looks the same. It all sort of feels like it's too bright, or it all feels like it's too dark. And again, our eyes and our brains play tricks on us, where it fills in data so that it doesn't ever look like we're ever losing data like we are in this case of a digital sensor. But it is very much the case where our eyes, or the average human's eye, I suppose I should say, cannot detect more than 13 stops in a bright day. Did I see a question? Yeah, it's as far as I know, it's just the average eye. I mean, all of us will have variances, for better or for worse. But I'm just talking on average, and even these averages, even though they're not the best numbers, they are good for relative comparisons from our eyes to that of a camera to even that of how our eyes behave in the daytime versus the nighttime, which was actually my next point. So in the daytime, we get about 13 stops difference. In the nighttime, we actually have a greater dynamic range. We can actually see about a 20-stop difference in the amount of light. So whereas in the day we had 13 stops and about 10,000 to 1 difference in brightness, we can actually get a million to 1, or about a million to 1 difference in brightness at night. And that's just the way that, because we are using different cells. You might recall that we use the rod cells rather than the cones for night vision, and they are much better at having such a huge dynamic range. And this contrasts to modern cameras. And modern cameras cannot really get that many stops of dynamic range. Many of them will, And compact cameras actually are a little bit worse in this regard than digital SLRs. Digital SLRs tend to have a higher dynamic range than their compact camera cousins, but generally what you will see is something in the range of about 12 or 13 stops for a digital SLR and maybe 8 to 10 stops for compact camera. And again, these are generalizations. There will be variances within different models and different sensors, but still, that's generally what they are. And so, even the best camera does not have the dynamic range that our eye is capable of producing. And our eye can even vary the dynamic range by looking around. So all this instantaneous dynamic range that I just mentioned, where if you're looking in one spot, you get 13 stops of dynamic range in a bright day, this actually can change if you move your eye around, because as we move our eye around, our cells are try to compensate for it. Our iris will automatically open or close, and so we, even for a given scene, we can have a much greater range of dynamic range that our eyes are capable of seeing. So for this scene, for example, you can imagine that this is not a really small scene. I mean, this is a bridge, and if you're standing right here, you're going to have to move your eyes to be able to see detail inside here versus what is out there. And you're not going to notice it necessarily, but you will still be able to see details, even if the dynamic range of this scene is still greater than about 13 stops, because our eyes dynamically change while we look at different portions of the scene. We would be able to see the dark details that are inside of the bridge and the bright details that are outside in the sky. And so this is something that you have to identify. You start to get a feel for it after a while, and that you might look at a scene overall and say, this feels like it has too much dynamic range. And eventually, you'll start to hone in on that and realize how much dynamic range, while you are capable of viewing the entire scene, your camera is definitely limited, and you will start to get a feel for how much your camera is capable of capturing. So why then do cameras have this limitation of dynamic range? Well, we can think of the pixels in a camera like buckets. And in this analogy, these pixels are big buckets, and they collect rainwater that's falling. And in this analogy, the rainwater are photons that are coming from the scene. So the more photons or the more rain that we catch, the brighter this scene will appear to be. Now, but because this is a bucket, This obviously is not an infinitely sized bucket. We can only fit so many raindrops within this bucket. If we overfill the bucket, what's going to happen? If we fill up the bucket and we keep putting more rain into this bucket, it's going to overflow, and we're not going to be able to record how much rain fell in that bucket, because we have no idea. It is not capable of capturing more photons or more raindrops than its maximum capacity. And there is certainly a minimum amount as well that we can collect. And if you only have a couple of drops of rain in this bucket, for example, you might look at it and you might say, well, I don't know how much rain this is. I mean, it's a pretty big bucket and it's one or two drops of rain. There's obvious that there's something in here, but I have to essentially call it zero. So there's a minimum also that of rain or photons that we can collect and that we would be able to measure. And that's what's important here, is being able to measure the amount. So yes, we would be able to collect one or two, but just because those one or two are in there doesn't mean that we can measure those two. We can't really give it a good quantity without providing some error in our measurement. That's exactly what happens here. So the dynamic range is very simply the maximum quantity of light that our bucket or our sensor or our pixel can capture divided by the smallest detectable signal. So this is probably, this is a relatively simple concept, but it's really, really important. And this dynamic range is just the biggest signal, or a full bucket divided by the smallest detectable signal. So you can imagine that there might be ways that we can modify the dynamic range of a sensor. So imagine, so what's one way that we would be able to capture a larger dynamic range? So remember, all we need to do to make a larger dynamic range is to increase the top portion here, increase the biggest signal, which essentially just means that we need a bigger bucket. If we have a bigger bucket, then we could collect more. We could collect more rainwater. So whereas if we had a bucket that was, this high and we collected rainwater in it, we could measure that much. But if we had a bucket that was now this high, we can collect collect that much more rainwater and be able to detect that much more photons in this analogy, be able to make a better determination, be able to capture a larger range of photons and raindrops, so to speak. Yes?
Is this where shooting in raw comes
into play? Yes, shooting in raw actually, it makes a big difference. And yes, it's actually a point that I was going to bring up and might as well do it now. When you take a photo in JPEG format, what has to happen is no matter what the dynamic range of your camera happens to be, there has to be some mathematical process inside the camera that can fit it within the constraints of a JPEG file. So you might recall that our JPEG files can store 8 bits of information, right? So we can have, for the color blue, for example, 0 to 255 values within it. So 256 total values within that blue pixel in a JPEG. What this means is that no matter how large of a dynamic range we have in our camera, we have to somehow squeeze it all into those 256 bits that exist in a JPEG file. And most of the time, this is fine. Most of the time, this is not a big deal. And even with large dynamic range cameras, you can actually get a pretty good representation of the scene in the image. But there are downsides to this as well, is that you are going to have to throw away some data. Your camera might be capable of capturing a great many different amounts of values. So if you have, it might be able to capture, for example, 1,000 different values rather than just 256 that we would store in a JPEG. And so you have to throw away a good percentage of this data in order to fit this data into a JPEG file. And so this is one of the strongest reasons why people recommend using the RAW format, is because using RAW, you store all of the original data that comes off of the pixel. So you are storing all of the data as the pixel recorded it, which means you are not throwing away data prematurely. And while you will probably process the file into a JPEG, you have a better chance of getting it the way you want it, because you have all of those original pixels. And you can actually, you will be actually throwing away an enormous amount of data if you always take photos in JPEG. And it's just the nature of the beast. Like, they have to be able to fit it into a JPEG format. And JPEG format, while it is actually pretty good, it can't store as much data that most of these sensors are capable of producing. So this is important. If you want to get the best quality out of your camera and out of your photos, taking them in RAW and processing them later is the best way to ensure that. Yes?
Can you back up a little bit?
Mm-hmm.
You say that if you want a bigger dynamic range, you need a larger bucket.
Mm-hmm.
But if a bucket is a pixel
is a pixel on a sensor, yes. But you can have one sensor that has a specific size. It might be a relatively small sensor. And imagine if you had another sensor that was much bigger than this one, and it had the same number of megapixels. If it has the same number of pixels, the larger sensor will have bigger pixels. So this is one way that... So it's not just that the pixel size will be different in one sensor. Usually, all of the pixels in one sensor are uniform. I'm not sure... Well, there's a couple of examples where they're not, and we'll talk about those during the sensor, when we talk about sensors, of course, in a later date. But between sensors, you might have a digital SLR, for example, that has a relatively large sensor within it, something that's near the size of a 35-millimeter frame. And when you compare this to the sensor size of a compact camera, you realize that the compact camera, even though it has about the same number of pixels, it's just a much smaller sensor, which means that something has to give, and in this case, it's the size of the pixels themselves. So you're going to have a much smaller range that you will be able to capture in a compact camera. Now, of course, there are other ways other than just creating a bigger bucket to increase the dynamic range. Remember that one of the things that I mentioned was at the low end, what happens is you have like this error from having too few photons in the bucket or having too few raindrops in the bucket. You could improve the electronics that actually measure all of the photons, and that way if they can measure more accurately the small quantity of photons that exist within the bucket, this is another way of modifying the dynamic range as well. So if you make the smallest detectable signal even smaller, in effect, you are getting also a larger dynamic range. So the best way to improve dynamic range is to do both. Get a bigger bucket, get a bigger pixel that can store a wider range of photons, but also improve the electronics in such a way that you can record a smaller signal, that you can record fewer photons, that the fewest photons that happen to exist within that bucket. And frankly, we are getting now, technology is getting so good that the smallest detectable signal is almost to the point of individual photons. We can detect just a couple of photons, and that is usually enough in the case of these sensors. And so we're some people are saying that we're reaching this sort of technological limit, and I mean, it remains to be seen. Of course, we'll talk more about this later on, so on and so forth. But still, this is an important distinction, that just because you have a small pixel doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to have a poor dynamic range. This is one of the reasons why compact cameras have improved so much over the years. Their pixels aren't getting any bigger. In fact, they're getting smaller because they're fitting more pixels into these same size sensors, but they're doing a better job of detecting the smallest signals that exist within that pixel as well. Therefore, they're getting a better dynamic range out of these much smaller sensors. Okay, so we talked about a couple of things. So just to reiterate, what happens if we overfill the bucket is that, you know, water spills out. And essentially, this happens in almost in a literal sense in a sensor as well, in that if you have photons that are coming into this pixel and you have so many photons that it overflows, you will occasionally see that those pixels literally overflow to surrounding pixels as well. And you get this effect called blooming. And blooming is just that, where even though you might have had one pixel, only one pixel that was really heavily overexposed, it sort of bled this overexposure to neighboring pixels as well. So in this sense, this analogy almost holds pretty well, in that we can have neighboring buckets adjacent to each other, and if you fill up one bucket too much, it's going to spill over into neighboring ones. That's the same idea as this concept of blooming. And this is another reason why overexposing is such a bad idea, because you could not only destroy data in one pixel, but you could destroy it in adjacent pixels as well. And usually this happens on a large scale, where you actually are getting rid of data on a lot of pixels in a row versus just one or two individual pixels. So if no photons happen to hit this pixel, then we are unable to measure it, or even if we have just a couple of photons, we're unable to measure it. We might get some noise, and this is one of the reasons why we see noise in the darker regions of the scene, just because the camera's unable to accurately detect how many photons actually exist in that pixel, and it's not really making a guess, but there's an error in this particular case. So if you have... So again, if you take photos in the raw formats, you're preserving all of the data off of the sensor. You're able to maintain all this entire dynamic range out of it, and you will be able to ensure that you can get the best photo possible out of your camera. And so this is one of the main benefits of using the raw file. Now, when we're talking about dynamic range in scenes, now we can actually talk about the dynamic range in a number of contexts. So the dynamic range of a scene, for example, is the difference in brightness of the scene itself. So we talked about the dynamic range of this scene here, which might have been very, very high, just because the darkest regions of the bridge are much darker than the brightest regions in the sky. And typically, let's see, like I said, DSLRs are doing better about it. You can typically get maybe 10 to 12 stops. Compact cameras, what did I say before, something like 7, 8. Used to be about 5 or 6 stops for compact cameras, and now they do seem to be getting better, so now you might get about 7 to 8 stops of dynamic range. Generally, the older the camera, also the worse dynamic range you will get, and you can generally see this also in camera phones, for example, and especially in older camera phones. You try to take a picture, and you can see that very quickly do you start to get overexposure within this scene. And that's not because the scene had a ridiculously high dynamic range. It's just that this tiny little sensor in this camera phone just did not have the dynamic range capable of capturing all of the differences in the pixels. So we talked briefly about why the dynamic range of an SLR might be better, but I'll have to leave this as sort of something for you to think about until one of the upcoming weeks, when we'll actually talk more about pixels and sensors themselves in an upcoming lecture. Okay, any questions on this before we move on? All right, so I've been talking at length now about using this as a reason or why you might want to use raw files over something else like JPEG. And being able to manipulate a raw photo is actually an important thing to do. And in fact, it's something that I want to talk about today. And so today, one of the things we're going to be talking about is the first of a couple lectures on Photoshop, and where we'll actually talk about some of the things that you can do with Photoshop, specifically as they relate to digital photography. And we'll even get to some of the neat, fancy things like high dynamic range photos, HDR photos, but not today. Today is some of the basics of Photoshop, where we talk about channels, layers, opening a raw photo in Photoshop, doing masking, these sorts of things. But they're all very useful and very, very powerful. As you'll see, a number of photos that you've even seen in lecture have used one or more of these methods in the past. So for us to be able to do this, we first need to open up Photoshop, and let's see, I think I'm going to have to do this slightly differently. Now, Photoshop, of course, is, I mentioned before that unfortunately this year the school's arrangement seems to be a little bit different with Adobe, in that whereas in previous years we used to be able to download Photoshop for free and use it as part of, as long as we were members of FAS or part of the extension school. Now we don't have that anymore. And so what's going to happen is that you can actually download a trial version of Photoshop that's fully functional for 30 days, but don't do that right now. Don't go home and do that. The reason is that you are very likely going to need Photoshop for your final project, and you're definitely going to need it for the final problem set, the one that wasn't released today, but the one that will be released 3 weeks from now. So I would recommend waiting until the last moment to download this trial onto your computer. It will work fully functional for 30 days, but only for those 30 days, after which you'll have to spend a whole bunch of money to actually get it to work again on your computer. If that does happen, where you have the trial and it does expire on you, realize that you're not completely out of luck. All of the machines in the labs here on campus have Photoshop installed on them, and you can use them to do your work as well. So that includes the Church Street Lab, and the Science Center machines will have Photoshop on them for you to work on. But this is why I'm recommending to wait to download the trial version of Photoshop, because I'm sure most of you will want to do the work on your own computer. So don't do it quite yet, but we'll start looking at some of this stuff today. Yes? Right.
You can't buy it, and that's in the basement of the Science Center.
Right, that's right. So in the basements of the Science Center, there you can go to the Media Technology Services, I believe it's called, and you can actually purchase a license for Photoshop at a greatly reduced rate. But even this greatly reduced rate is expensive. But it is a good option. If you are interested in buying Photoshop, definitely I recommend that you take advantage of the education discount, because it is a good discount off of the full amount. Computers.harvard.edu. Okay, so you can also go online and do the same. Yes.
Does it have to be Photoshop specifically for the final project, or just tools that edit photos in a certain way? For example, I'd like to use something that I can continue to use after the class. So learning Photoshop when I'm not going to buy it.
You can use whatever software you would like. It's just that Photoshop is sort of the de facto standard for all of these manipulations, and so that's why we're going to be showing it. There are other software packages out there that will do similar features, but it might work slightly differently, but still you're welcome to use whichever you prefer. But with that in mind, we can now load up Photoshop. This is one of the photos that I mentioned before, where I had modified it in using Photoshop, and we'll talk about how we modify this image, of course, at a later time. But I wanted to, frankly, I have this photo open because it's such a huge file, and my computer runs so slow these days that I have to open it now, or we will be in bad shape. Okay, so if I want to just open up a raw file, for example, I might take something that looks like this one right here, maybe. Okay, this one, and open it. And so generally what happens is that you can download a set of raw files to your computer, open up Photoshop and you can just open the raw file as you would any other image in Photoshop. And what happens is that with the modern version of Photoshop, and by the way, this version of Photoshop that I'm showing you is CS4, it's one version older than what actually exists now. I don't have a CS5 license quite yet. But they will work essentially the same. The trial version that you'll download online will be CS5 as well. And that actually has some neat features over CS4, but still, I'm just disclaiming that it might look a little bit different, but hopefully not too much. So when you try to open a raw file in Photoshop, you'll notice that it gives you this window. And this window is part of a plugin of Photoshop called Adobe Camera Raw. And this is actually, you can think of this plugin as being a separate program to Photoshop, but it requires Photoshop for its use, if that makes sense. And the reason that I say that it's separate is because you can actually download updates to Adobe Camera Raw separately from Photoshop to allow yourself to be able to open RAW files from other cameras. So RAW files differ generally by not only between manufacturer to manufacturer, but even from model to model. So older versions of Canon RAW files, for example, are different than the newer versions of Canon RAW files. So even one generation newer, you will have an entirely different version of the RAW file. And what has to happen is that Adobe will have to generate a new version of the program that can understand that type of RAW file for you to be able to open it. So, assuming that Adobe Camera Raw supports your camera, and assuming that you have Photoshop downloaded, and assuming you have the latest version of Adobe Camera Raw installed, then this will happen. You download your RAW files to your computer, you open them in Photoshop, and Adobe Camera Raw opens automatically. We can see the photo as it was taken, and perhaps we want to perform some modifications to it. And because this is a RAW file, we have a large amount of leeway in the modifications that we can do without really impacting its quality in a negative way. If we do some of these same modifications on a JPEG file, you'll notice artifacts much more quickly than you will with a RAW file. So take a look at the far right over here of the screen. You'll notice that at the top we have a histogram. And this histogram looks maybe kind of sort of familiar to what we've seen before. What sort of histogram is this, or might this be? So RGB is a good guess. It seems to be when you see individual colors like this, usually it's the individual color channels, but put one on top of the other. So we see the red color channel, and that's the red one. We see the green color channel, that's the green one, and the blue color channel, that's the blue one. And the mixture of those, you can see the mixture in the colors. So for example, whenever red and green match, then we see the yellow. Whenever green and blue match, we see this little bit of cyan. Let's see, I'll zoom in a little bit so that we can see where some of these overlap. But don't get confused. I know there's sort of a lot of colors here that can get kind of confusing, but there's the three major ones, the red, the green, and the blue, and the combinations form these other colors. So the red and the green make this yellow, and you can see that they share this yellow portion. The green and the blue share this cyan portion that makes the cyan. Then when you have the presence of all three, you see this white portion of the histogram here. We should be able to change it, though, you can change the histogram that's shown if you want to use something other than colors, but this is available to you for use. So if we continue moving down, we can see a few of the other options as well. So for example, we can see how this photo was taken, what settings were used. It was taken at an aperture of f5.6 at 1/5000th of a second at ISO 100 using a 70 to 200 millimeter lens zoomed in to 121 millimeters. And from here, you'll notice that you actually start to get to some of the really interesting things that you can change, the first of which is white balance. And we'll talk more about what white balance means in the color lecture, but you can essentially change the color temperature. You can change the appearance of the colors in the photo by adjusting the white balance. And sometimes, especially if you have a Canon camera and you're using it indoors in incandescent lighting, Canon cameras love to get incandescent lighting white balance incorrect. It looks far too warm. And using this, you can modify the look of that. So for example, if I want to make it look a little bit more blue, I can go this direction. Of course, you can also make it look completely alien and outlandish. And I can go the other way as well. So completely changing the look of this image, but it really has to do, and this might be a poor image to see how color balance actually, or how white balance is affected. But we can use this to get rid of those tinges of color that may exist from the camera's inability to get the white balance correct as shown. Now, other interesting things as we continue to move down, you'll notice that we have some exposure-related controls. So I mentioned before that it's a good idea to get the exposure right on the first try. And that's certainly true, and that will always be true. If you get the exposure right on the first try, you'll have far less work for yourself. But that's not always possible. And when you take photos in the raw format, you actually have a lot more leeway in adjusting the exposure because, as you might recall, when you save the photos in the raw format, you're saving the entire dynamic range of the sensor into this file. And this is different from JPEG, where if you save it as a JPEG, what you see is what you get. That's the entire dynamic range. But here in the raw file, there's data that you just don't see that is available for you to be able to recover. So if I thought that this was a little too dark, I might be able to increase the exposure a little bit. You'll notice that it starts giving me a warning with these red pixels whenever I start to overexpose certain pixels. I can even go the other way and try to decrease the exposure after the fact to give it a more darker view. And you can actually do some really amazing things with this. You can actually recover photos. You will be surprised. I've told you that if you take a photo and you see it and it looks like you've gotten rid of some details because you've overexposed them, you might be surprised that you can actually recover maybe about a stop to two stops worth of overexposed details, sometimes in a variety of photographs, just by using this exposure slider after the fact. There is a hard limit, though. You really can't recover much more than two stops worth of exposure, because it's beyond that, you've just exceeded the dynamic range of your camera. You're just not going to be able to recover that information. But this does provide some leeway. So this isn't a fix-all, but that you can use it to help out with some minor exposure corrections that you might have. The next few are kind of specific. Now realize that a lot of this information that I've been showing you and telling you applies not just to Photoshop, but to other RAW processors as well. So you might use Aperture, or you might use iPhoto, or you might use some other software. And a lot of these options are actually shared. They're actually the same between them. But sometimes they actually will call these settings, or some of the more specific settings, by a different name. So exposure, it'll generally always be called exposure from one program to the next because you're affecting the brightness of it. Recovery starts... most RAW programs actually have this concept of recovery, but it's a little bit different in Photoshop than it is in others. So, for example, if you modify the recovery, you'll notice that what it is doing is that it seems to be making the bright areas darker. So you'll notice that right here, so pay attention to here where the sun is, and if I increase the recovery, you'll notice that in general it becomes darker. So recovery is attempting to do to retrieve values that you've lost in overexposed areas without affecting the exposure of other areas as well. So you'll notice that even though I did this, and again, man, this was probably not the best RAW file to use for this particular example because this is already sort of silhouette, but had this been taken in such a way that the sky was very overexposed, as an example, then you might be able to recover some of those data using recovery without having to affect the exposure of the entire scene as a whole. Now, fill light is a little bit different. It's actually the opposite. It will brighten the dark regions of a scene. So in the silhouette portions here, I can add some fill light, and we can actually start to see some of the details that exist here. You can start to see some of the rocks. You can actually see the features on the climbers themselves. And again, this is actually, I think, an impressive display of how much data actually exists in a RAW file just by using some of these sliders. So here we can now really see the actual detail that was before just in complete shadow. Okay. Let's see, so I'll go back here. Now let's see. Blacks, this slider essentially seems to be increasing the black point. We'll talk about what the black point is in just a little bit, so I just want to do a little bit of hand waving when we talk about levels. Hopefully this black slider will become more apparent. Let's see, so we have also brightness. which differs from exposure in some way and contrast. And I think that most of the time what you will end up doing is, first of all, modifying the exposure for the overall scene by some amount. If you notice that the dynamic range of the scene is captured is a little bit too high, most likely you'll use recovery or fill light as appropriate to try to bring down the bright areas or bring up the dark areas of the scene as appropriate. And then you might want to fill a little bit with the contrast. Now realize that increasing the contrast is sort of at odds with making the brighter regions darker and the darker regions brighter, because in effect they are opposite things. So you'll notice that if I increase the contrast, notice that what happens is that the darker regions are becoming darker and the lighter regions are becoming brighter. That's exactly what contrast does, is that it makes the apparent dynamic range of the scene higher. So in other words, we've made this more of a silhouette by using the contrast, just because we've made some of these areas that were already in shadow now much more in shadow, and we've brightened up the sky just a little bit. And if we decrease the contrast quite a bit, we'll see that we actually have a difference. We're actually recovering some of the details. So you have to be careful with overuse of the contrast, because overusing the contrast can have essentially the same effect as overexposing the scene as well. You might lose some details, you might clip some channels because you're increasing the contrast of the scene a little bit too much. So another one that's neat, I think, is saturation. Usually some of the best ways to improve the look of your photograph is to increase the contrast and increase the saturation, because that will really make your colors pop. So for example, increase the contrast and increase the saturation. Now we get a photo that looks like this, which looks a bit more stunning than the original version that we had, which was this, which was much more gray, much less exciting, much less interesting. But increasing the saturation and increasing the contrast are some of the best ways to do it. Now, if you take nothing else away from this lecture, it is to use these two sliders to your advantage, not for assignments for this class, but whenever you're showing photos off to your friends or family or what have you, increasing the contrast and saturation is a good way to impress people with the colors in your photo. But again, be careful not to overdo it. It's really easy to overdo these sliders and get something that looks cartoonish or looks a little bit silly. You'll have to weigh for yourself just how much you want to use on a per image basis. Okay, now let's see. I have to move the dock out of the way so we can see some of this other stuff. So now if we take a look at some of the details that are at the very bottom, we'll notice that we have this, what looks like a link, at the very, very bottom of the window down here. It says Adobe RGB 1998, 8-bit, 5184 by 3456, 17.9 MP, 240 PPI. This is basically information about the file that will come as a result of you processing this. So you'll notice that there's a couple of buttons down here in the lower right-hand corner, like Open Image. What Open Image will do is to apply all of these settings that you've made, all of these changes that you've made to the raw settings, and it will open up the image in Photoshop. And then you can save that image as a JPEG to send to somebody else, or you can manipulate it even further or do whatever you want. But basically, once you're done with the Adobe Camera Raw, you'll click Open Image. But before you do that, it's good to pay attention to this link, because here you can actually modify some additional settings about that resulting image itself. So if you click on it, you'll notice that you get some additional options, like space. This is color space. We'll talk about this when we talk about color in a few lectures. Generally, or rather almost always, will you want to use sRGB. Almost always. Sometimes you'll want to use Adobe RGB. Sometimes you want to use other ones. But pretty much all the time will you use sRGB. Depth, 8 bits per channel. You know, we talked about what this means. This is good for JPEG files. JPEG files use 8 bits per channel, which means that there's 256 discrete values for the red, the green, and the blue channel, respectively. But you can actually increase it to 16 bits per channel. I would say that if you were going to The decision process here should be that if you're going to perform some light modifications to this image, so you've just modified some of the camera raw settings, you're going to open it and save it as a JPEG almost immediately, 8 bits is probably good. But if you're going to start doing some heavy modifications after this image is processed, maybe you're going to start doing some heavy masking, maybe you're start going to combine this image with another image, then 16 bits per channel will give you a bigger range of options in terms of quality. You will get a much bigger file size, and you can't save this as a JPEG file, but it's good to manipulate photos. You will retain the quantity of data that comes with the raw file by using a higher bit depth. So if we're going to save it as a JPEG file, 8 bits per channel is the way to go. Size, now if you wanted to resize the image by default, this is probably a good way to do it, but frankly many of the options that it gives you are probably not ideal. We can decrease the size if you want. You might have a reason to make an image bigger, but I think it better be a damn good reason. There's really almost no really good reason why you would want to increase the pixels in an image. The reason is that the computer is just going to have to guess. You're doing essentially a digital zoom where it just has to guess the intermediate pixels, and this isn't going to be a very high quality increase in the number of pixels. You can do it, but you better know what you're doing. So keep it at the maximum if you want to and work with that. But I think, again, just be really sure of yourself if you're going to use a higher size than normal. Now, resolution, this can actually be confusing for a number of people, but it really doesn't need to be. All resolution means is the number of pixels in an inch if you were to print this image on paper. So when we're looking at this picture on a computer screen, this resolution can frankly be anything. It doesn't matter. The computer will show you the image in whatever resolution your screen is capable of producing. This is not really applicable to displaying this on a computer screen. Where it is applicable is if you wanted to print it. So if you wanted to print it at a very high quality, because maybe you're going to print it on some high quality print of, 8x10 or something like that, then you might want to increase the resolution. Now realize that this resolution doesn't impact the size. The size is the number of pixels that this image takes up. What this resolution changes is the number of inches that this image will take up if you were to print it. So if I have a size of this, about 18 megapixels, and I increased the resolution from 240 to about 300, what this means is that if I print this image, an image at that size with this resolution will be smaller than the image at that size at the lower resolution, if that makes sense, because there's fewer pixels in an inch in the lower resolution, so it will take up more inches on a printed space. So you can consider the size and the resolution to be almost independent, but where they are linked is in the size of a printout itself. So if you are going to print out something at 8x10, you need to find the resolution at that size that will allow you to print it at 8x10. We'll look at a tool that will allow us to fix this a little bit in a little bit. So if you actually needed to increase the size, you might also want to sharpen the image as well. You would then use this sharpen 4 pull down, depending on the whatever the destination of this image might be. So once you've made your changes, you can hit OK, and you'll notice that the blue text at the bottom has now been changed to reflect our new settings. sRGB color space 8-bit, because we're going to send it to a JPEG. We're still using the original resolution and 300 pixels per inch. Now, there's other options here as well, like a tone curve, some sharpening. Sharpening is actually pretty useful, and we will talk about sharpening, you know, later, of course, blah blah blah. But most of these are we'll talk about at a later date, and curve we'll talk about just a little bit today. But I just wanted to show you the basic settings that we would use. So when I'm done with all of those settings, I click Open Image, and hopefully your computer is a little bit faster than mine in processing this. One of the downsides to having such a high megapixel camera is that it takes a computer a long time to process it. But once that's done, now I can see that I have this image here. And now we can work with photos. Photoshop. Now, one of the things about Photoshop is that it is, if you have not used it before, it is overwhelming. It is almost scarily overwhelming. And we'll talk about the layout and how you can use all of these things. But if you recall, I mentioned before that there was this series of Photoshop tutorials called You Suck at Photoshop, which was much more of a, it's frankly just more of a comedic tutorial than an actual useful tutorial, I think. But he makes this joke there that, no matter how much Photoshop you use, you're pretty much only going to be using $20 of the $600 worth of Photoshop. And that's certainly very true. So after the 5-minute break, you will learn $20 worth of $600 of Photoshop. So we'll take a 5-minute break and come back. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. So before the break, I showed you how to use Adobe Camera Raw to open a RAW file in Photoshop. So just to make perfectly clear what's happening, Photoshop itself does not and cannot understand the RAW file. But there is this plugin called Adobe Camera Raw that allows, that converts a RAW file. It does understand RAW files, and it converts the RAW file. It processes it to a file format that Photoshop does understand. And the two are actually pretty closely knit. So in essence, you can think of them as being the same program, but they are considered to be separate because Adobe Camera Raw can be updated more frequently than Photoshop. So you could download updates for Adobe Camera Raw independently of Photoshop. That's really where this distinction comes into play. So it doesn't really matter how you try to open a RAW file in Photoshop, whether you go to File, Open, you drag a file into Photoshop's icon, it doesn't really matter. Either one of these methods will allow you to select a RAW file in your file system, and when you hit Open, it automatically opens Adobe Camera Raw. So like here, Adobe Camera Raw is open, and this is the same screen that we saw before. This would allow us to make modifications to this image before we bring it into Photoshop. So you have to process the image with Adobe Camera Raw before you can start to edit it in Photoshop. So just to show you one more example of how I might modify an image in Adobe Camera Raw, I have this photo, which is of hail at the top of Pikes Peak in the middle of August. And obviously, I didn't do a very good job looking at my histogram, because you can see that, and again, just looking at this, it might look kind of whitish, but looking at the histogram, we can see that there's actually a big gap from the brightest regions of this image to the far right of this histogram. So there's obviously, I didn't set the exposure compensation properly. I didn't have it high enough for this particular image. So I can do the manual exposure compensation here and rescue this image. And so adding about 2/3 of a stop of exposure compensation after the fact is going to perhaps rescue this image from being sort of gray and dreary into being more like what it looked like to begin with, which was this white scene. And so from here, there's not a lot of, you can tell that looking at the histogram, there's not a lot of contrast. The contrast is a more contrasty image will have a wider histogram. A very narrow histogram like this represents an image that just does not have a lot of contrast in it. So I can actually increase the contrast a little bit here as well, and maybe even the saturation, just to give this photo a little bit more pop. So this was before, and let's see if I can do this. This was before, and I have to do this again now. And this is after. So it has a bit more pop, and it makes it a little bit more interesting of a photograph. Now, if I wanted to make some modifications, and we will be making some modifications to images in Photoshop, I can set the depth to 16 bits per pixel. This means that I can't save it as a JPEG file yet, but I can work with it in Photoshop. So I'll set it as 16 bits, hit OK, then hit Enter for Open Image. And what happens eventually is that it will process the RAW file and it will open it in Photoshop. So it's processing it into a file format that Photoshop does actually understand. And eventually, if I can continue talking for long enough, it will actually open the processed image and we can work with it in Photoshop, converting it down to 8 bits per pixel, doing mother modifications, including, okay, good. So here, if I wanted to do something like convert it down to 8 bits per pixel, you go to the image and then mode menu. You notice that right now 16 bits per pixel is checked. If I wanted to save it as a JPEG file, I would have to go to 8 bits per pixel. But be careful, this is a destructive change. When I click on this button, it's going to change it to be 8 bits, and now this image is no longer 16 bits. So I've told Photoshop to throw away the extra data that's not quite visible to us but exists in memory so that I can save it as a JPEG file. So now I could go to File, Save As, and save it as a JPEG file on my desktop, for example, or what have you. But in this case, I'll go back to my 16 bits. Now you notice that at the top of the window, we actually see a little bit of information. We see the name of the file, image 6556.cr2. CR2 is just the file name or the file extension for a Canon RAW format file. At 12.5%, that's the zoom. So if I were to go to 100% zoom, there'd be, you know, huge. The photo itself would be huge, but right now it's trying to fit it within the window available to us. We see RGB/16. So this is telling us the color mode and the color depth that we are using. We are using 16 bits of color. If I changed it to 8, that's when that 16 will actually change to 8, and we'll be able to see that we're actually in 8-bit color mode instead. You can see the /8 now in 8-bit color mode. All right, so let's see. Other things that are sort of basic in Photoshop include image resize and crop. So resizing images you can do directly through the image size menu option here. You'll notice that we get a variety of options, and one of them is this sort of dreaded resolution moniker that we were talking about a little while ago. But notice that we have a couple of different things. Notice that there's basically two major sections. There's a pixel dimensions section, and then there is a document size. So pixel dimensions, this is really what you should care about. This is where you should spend the majority of your time if your images are going to be destined for the computer. Maybe you're going to post them online, send them in an email or what have you, but if you don't really care about what's going to happen with it with regards to print, then you can pretty much ignore document size. Okay, so we can see the pixel dimensions. It's about 5,200 pixels wide and about 3,500 pixels high. And you'll notice that there is a little chain connecting the two via that square bracket on the right side. This means that when I make a modification to this, it will change the other dimension a corresponding amount. So it will change, it will resize the image without changing the aspect ratio. So if I wanted 1,000 pixels wide, you'll notice that the height changed a corresponding amount as well. Now, what might be more useful than using straight up pixels would be to use percent. So maybe instead of, maybe instead of using 100%, for example, you want the image to be about the quarter of the size, and you can change it to be 25% of the original size. And it will change both the width and the height correspondingly. Now, if you want to alter one of these and not the other, you can actually unchain them by unclicking or by unchecking this box right here, constrain proportions. Constraining proportions means that it is going to keep the aspect ratio the same. When I uncheck that, you'll notice that chain is no longer there, and now I can change the width, and it is not going to change the height. So if I do something like this, I'm going to make it a quarter as tall and 2,500 times wider, which is going to be completely ridiculous, but it at least shows this point. Okay, so now with this in mind, usually you'll keep constrained proportions checked. Usually you'll have resample image checked, and you'll have it set to bicubic. You'll notice that you'll have other options as well. You could use bicubic smoother if you're making it bigger. You could use bicubic sharper for making images smaller. Generally, you'll use one of the bicubic options, though. It's just a way of allowing the computer to decide what to do with neighboring pixels that it's either throwing away or adding. It has to do something called resampling, and bicubic is right now the best resampling method that we have. This is the equivalent of enhance that everybody talks about, you know, zoom in and enhance. It's obviously not really enhancing, but it has to do something with those pixels, and that's what you can think of this part as. Okay, now, the document size, this is what happens, or this is what you would use if you're going to print your image. And you'll notice that you have a resolution and a width and a height. So this width and height defines how big in print this image is going to be at this resolution and with this set of pixels. So if I have pixel dimensions of 5200 by 3500 and I am printing this document at 300 pixels per inch, that means that I'll have 300 pixels for the first inch, 300 for the next inch, so on and so forth. That means that this image will print out at this resolution at about 17 inches wide by 11 inches tall. So if you want to change this document size, what can you do? Well, some people go straight to this document size and modify this first. So let's say they want maybe a 10 by 8, for example. Maybe I want this to be a little bit bigger, so maybe a 24-inch wide document. So I do that. You'll notice that it changes now the width and the height correspondingly, but notice what it did to the pixel dimensions up there. It increased them. And the reason for that is that I have set the resolution to be 300 pixels per inch. In order for Photoshop to be able to print this image at that resolution with this width and height, it has to make sure there are more pixels in this image. And this may or may not be what you want. Maybe instead what you want is to modify you can do it that method, but what I tend to do instead is to alter, to maintain the pixel dimensions and alter the resolution so that I get the width and the height that I want. So I'll remember that the width, the pixel width of this image is 5100 or 5184, and if I want that 24 by 16 image, I can now decrease the resolution to try to get to that amount. So even a resolution of 200 pixels per inch results in an image that is smaller, and I think decreasing the file size might be advantageous. It's not the best way in this case. You don't want to throw away pixels that you might want to use to print, but this is just a way of showing you that you can modify the resolution in a way that it modifies the document size. But in essence, what this resolution means is it really just affects the print of an image. And so if you are given frequently I'm asked questions like, you need to have a document at 3,600 pixels wide by, 3,000 pixels wide by 2,000 pixels high at a resolution of 300 pixels per inch. And this confuses people, but really all you're doing is just setting this value right here. You can very easily manually set the pixel width and height that you want, 3,000 by 2,000, and changing the resolution. You will be able to get the precise thing that you want. So let's see, what did I say, 3,000? So if you have a width of 10 and a height of about 6, then you get exactly that. You get a resolution of 300 with those pixel dimensions there, and you can hit OK, and it will resize the image. So I can hit OK to resize the image, but I don't want to in this case. So that's the image resize tool. Now, the other basic thing that you might use in Photoshop is the crop tool. Now, notice before I start to show you the crop tool, notice the way that Photoshop is laid out. Now, this screen is a little bit small. There's not a lot of space for all of the so-called palettes, but you have the menus along the top. You have a list of tools on the left side here, which include things like marquees, which allow you to perform selections, to pen tools, to pencil tools to actually make modifications on the image itself, to type tools, like this little T thing right here, which will allow you to actually type words or text onto your image. But there's more than just this. When you have one of the tools selected, and the one that's selected right now is this paint bucket tool, you'll see it over here, a little paint bucket tool, you actually have along the top, underneath the menu, a variety of options that you can change for that tool. So you'll notice right there, there's a little paint bucket. It says foreground. There's a mode. We'll talk about what all of these mean, but these are all different things that you can change for the paint bucket tool. So whatever tool happens to be selected, you can modify its options along the top there. Now along the right side, we have what are called palettes that show us a variety of information or about the image or about the document that we're editing. You'll notice that right here there's a color palette where we can actually change. There's these two little boxes of color right here, this sort of maroon color and that white background. These are called the foreground and background color, respectively, and you use these throughout Photoshop. You'll notice that these are referenced and used everywhere, like that same maroon and white is here in the toolbar, maroon and white foreground and background. Up here, when we were talking about options for the paint bucket tool, you notice that there was an option for background or foreground, rather. We could change it to be pattern, or we could even use in this pattern the background color as well. What this means is that it is telling you which color from that color palette you will be using. And if I wanted to change the foreground color, I could use this color palette to modify that color. So I could do something like this. You'll notice that now I have a much more green color as the foreground color. And whenever I use a tool that uses a foreground color, it will use this color. And another thing that you can do is to actually click on the foreground color itself, not only in the color palette, but also here in the toolbar. And it brings up this color picker, which we've seen before. This is what you use to pick colors, and you can type in manual red, green, and blue values to get a specific color. You can click on colors here to get the color that you want. It really doesn't matter how you pick the color, but you can pick it through any variety of methods. So moving on, you'll notice that we have some other things in some other palettes available to us as well. So like this, let's see, where is it? This one right here, for example, is history, which is basically just a list of undos that you have. So had we made any changes to this image, like for example, had I actually changed the image size, then what would happen is that it would show up in the history, or it should. Okay. Please hold while I get the spinning beach ball. But as you make modifications, you will see those modifications in the history. Oh, did it crash? Oh, great. Adobe. So what you will see is that the history of those modifications in that history box, and you can go back through them and select a... Oh, no. Oh, this is going to be fun. And you can make some modifications from there. Okay, it didn't crash. Okay, what's going on? Live demos, man. This stuff tends to always fail. Ignore. Okay, now I can try again. Cross fingers, or this is going to be a short lecture. Okay, phew. Okay, good. So as we wait for Photoshop to load, there are other palettes available as well. One of them is called Layers. There's another one called Channels. And Channels is exactly what we were talking about with respect to the color channels. I don't want to submit, where you can actually view the individual color channels from an image. So you can see just the red color channel, for example, just the green color channel, or you can see a combination of the two. And Layers is another palette that's really, really useful and is perhaps going to be one of the most useful things that you will use in Photoshop. You'll see that these palettes are over here. Layers and then Channels. Paths, we're not really going to be talking about much, but these two are really pretty useful. But they allow us quite a bit of leeway over each of these. Let's see. I'll open this one again. So if I have this image, this was a raw file that was converted to a Photoshop image, and it was actually modified. So there's some modification that was done to this image, and you will notice a couple of things about it, one of which is the layers, and that we can use channels to view individual color channels. Notice that we have RGB, red, green, and blue, and we'll talk later about what layer one mask actually means, but we can actually view the values of, say, the green color channel here. You'll notice that it converts it to a grayscale. That's just because it's just looking at these raw values. It's just making zero black and white 255. So wherever there is white, that means that there is the complete presence of green in this image. Wherever there is black, that means there is absence of green. But we can show all colors as well from here. Layers is really useful. We'll be talking about that. But with that sort of really brief tour around Photoshop, let's look back on our toolbar on the left side and use this tool over here called the crop tool, it's this one right there, to be able to crop this image down. So if I use this crop tool, you select it, and then you'll notice that when I hover my mouse over an image, The icon changes depending on the tool that I'm using. So this is the crop tool. And I can select an image or a portion of the image that I want to crop. It will very nicely dim the remaining parts of the image. I can, if I'm happy with this selection, I can hit Enter. And it will crop the image. And I can go here now to, you'll see under History that it is actually set crop as one of my history items. And if I want to go back, I can go back to open to this original item. Now, one of the neat things about the crop tool is that if you have a crop that is not perfectly straight like this, let's say you want to try to get a crop of an image and then you want to rotate it a little bit, it's certainly possible to first crop the image like this and then use an image rotation tool like this. So image rotation, arbitrary, and then I want to change it by like 5 degrees. Hopefully it will do it and not crash. And you'll see that the whole image rotates by a certain amount, then I would have to crop again. This is sort of a not ideal scenario. I guess a better way to do this would be to first rotate the original, to use image rotation, do 5 degrees on the original document, and then when that's rotated, then you can crop that rotated thing. But I am going to, why did I actually do this? But there is actually a better way of achieving this same goal. If you actually want to crop an image that is not straight, you can actually use the crop tool and rotate it a little bit. And then when you hit enter, it will actually do both operations at the same time. Oh no, cancel, abort. Okay, so if I'm going to use the crop tool, I can do this. Now, one of the neat things about having a selection made of the image that appears like this is that you can actually modify it. Notice that you have these modifiers, these like little handles at the edge of the selection. There's this little box right here. I could grab this box and extend it to make the crop larger, for example. Let's see, I can make it larger or smaller or what have you. I can click in the middle and move it around. But you'll notice that if I move my mouse directly underneath, just a little bit beyond that sort of stretch that you saw, it turns to this angle thing. And this is what you can do to just angle one of these selections. Nope, come on, like this. And now what happens is when I hit enter, it will do both. It will crop out the image and then it will rotate it so that it is completely square. And we can see that now it's tilted in sort of a funny way. So we can sort of kill two birds with one stone using this crop tool. If you wanted to do something fancy like a rotate and a crop at the same time, this is particularly useful if you wanted to, if you took a photo and you noticed that the horizon wasn't level, you could certainly do that. You could certainly use this method to help you with that. And in fact, so if I had that issue where, and what I'm going to do is make this image a lot smaller so that it becomes easier to work with. So, okay, now that's not that small. So if I have an image that looks like this, and if, let's say that I had, in the original photo, I was bad enough of a photographer that the horizon was this badly out of alignment. And what you can do is use the crop tool to create a selection, and it's really easy to just get one edge of the crop tool to align with the horizon, and then you can expand it to fill everything that you want. So I can go up here, for example, and down here, or grab basically essentially the entire portion of the image that I want, and when I hit enter, it will crop and rotate, and I have automatically gotten a portion of the image out that will be that is now perfectly level. So this is a good way of leveling an image using the crop tool that might have been not very level before. Okay, any questions on this? Now, there are some other tools that are available as well. You'll notice that up here we have a move tool. This is not super useful right now, but it will become useful as we talk about layers. Now, the next few allow us to perform selections. So these selections, like rectangular marquee tool, the magic wand tool, all of these other tools allow you to select pixels, and then you can copy those pixels from one image to the next. You would be able to move them somewhere else. You can do any number of things just by selecting them. So I can select a certain section of images, for example, and I could go to copy and paste them somewhere else if I wanted to paste some pixels from one photo onto another. So if I wanted to add something to another photo, you might select it with a marquee tool, copy it, and then paste it in the other one. Another thing that I could do would be to move it. So I could use that move tool and move some of these pixels around. You notice how it's, okay, this looks sort of funky, but it's just because of the way that the layers are happening in this case. I'm moving some of these pixels around as well. And let's see. Moving on, and I know there's a lot of tools, so I just want to mention a few of them that are pretty useful. There's this heal tool over here, the spot healing brush tool, as it's called, and you can use this, and you can use this tool to correct blemishes on skin, for example. It might do some, let's see, I don't know if they have a separate, they do have a separate red eye tool as well. By the way, notice that most of these tools have little black triangles next to them. That little black triangle means that there's more tools available that are related to that one. So if you just click and hold on a tool, you'll get a menu showing you all of the available sub-tools for that. And so when you realize that all of these have different options, that it just becomes even more overwhelming. There's just so many more tools that are available. So you might use the healing brush tool or the spot healing brush tool to correct blemishes on skin, the red eye tool for, well, red eye, so on and so forth. Another useful one is this, the brush tool. The brush tool allows you to paint the color that you have selected onto the image itself. So I'll select a large, let's see, so you can see I'm painting red onto the image just using the brush tool. And notice that I do have options available up here where I can actually change the size of the brush, I can change the hardness. So having a high hardness means that it will be more circular. Making it not hard means that it will just have very, very soft edges, and usually this is a good way of getting just very smooth, soft color edits in a photo. You'll notice also that another option we have is opacity. We can make this less opaque so that you can see more of the pixels underneath, so on and so forth. But I suppose, let's see, this really should do probably this here so that you can see. So this is, if I paint it and it is completely opaque so that there's no transparency to it, you can see that there's no pixels visible underneath. I can, of course, decrease the opacity and have a much more subtle change in the color. All right, moving on. Let's see, so clone stamp tool. This was the tool of choice for many people when they wanted to remove objects out of a scene. They would use the clone stamp tool. Basically, what you do is you're given a brush with the clone stamp tool, and you select a region of the image using the Alt key, the Option key on Macs. You hold down the Alt key, and when that happens, you notice that the cursor changes. See how it changes from a little crosshair to now a crosshair with a circle around it? And using this, you select the region that you want to copy from. So I would select this region here, for example. I'll do this region over here. And now I can, using the, you know, after I've let go of this key, I can use the, I need a bigger brush for this. I can just use the regular mouse to paste over things here. And in this case, this is not quite the best example because the color is changing, but you sort of get the idea of how you can copy regions from one portion of an image to another to get rid of something within that image. There is, if you are using brushes on layers, then you can use the erase tool. The pen tool is neat, but it's a little complicated if you've never used it before. We'll probably talk about it at a later date, so on and so forth. The hand tool is useful if you want to, if you are very highly zoomed in and you want to go to another portion of the image. So I can use the hand tool to click and drag the image around. But there's a little trick here. I almost never select the hand tool because if I am in any other tool, like the paint bucket or the brush, all you have to do is push and hold down the space bar, and you'll notice that the mouse changes to a hand. And just by holding down the space bar, you can move around, you can move the image around without having to select the hand tool. So that's sort of a neat little trick. Then, of course, the magnifying glass for you to zoom in and zoom out. Okay, now, there's an important concept about Photoshop that's really vital to its role in using it, and that is this concept of layers. And you can think of as a layer on top of another layer as just being essentially a transparency. So let's say that you have this background, and I'll go back to the original photo here. We have this background. This was the original image that I took. It looked like this. And you'll notice that that is a layer by default here in Photoshop. There's another layer on top of it, but it's not visible right now. And I'll tell you how you can be sure of that in a minute. But we have one layer right now, and that is this right here. Now, it is possible for me to put another layer on top. You'll notice that in the layers palette, there's a whole range of icons in the lower right-hand corner, one of which is this sort of paper with a folded corner looking thing. That means a new layer button. You click this button, you'll get a new layer on top of whatever layer you are working on. So you'll notice that now I have this new layer called layer 2. And you'll see that that layer 2 really didn't make a difference. There's no change in the image itself. Just because there is a new layer on top of it doesn't mean that the image has been modified. Think of this again like a piece of transparency over your photo. So you have your photo in the bottom layer, and if you put a transparency on top of this layer, it really doesn't change how it looks. But if you made some modification, let's say you used a marker and you wrote on or you drew on this new transparency on top, you will see the change as though it's affecting the entire thing, but you are not destructively changing the photo underneath. So in other words, if I go back to my brush tool, and I want to just do a really obnoxious, painting the sky red sort of thing, something like this, you might say, oh no, Dan, you're ruining the image, and this is, you're never going to get those pixels back. Well, the great thing about having a layer is that you'll notice that all that red splotch is only in that layer. The rest of that layer is completely transparent. You don't see that layer except for whatever pixels are opaque in it, and I have not modified the layer underneath. I can just uncheck effectively one of the layers and I will see the layer underneath it and in its original form. So this is really crucial to the use of Photoshop. This is non-destructive editing. I can make edits to a photo or to an image without having to destructively change the pixels that make up the original image. So I can still preserve the original image, just make modifications to it, and that way if I want to make changes later on, then I can still go back to the original image and modify as appropriate. So there's a couple of things about the layers palette that you'll notice. First of all, you see that there's a little eye icon next to a layer. Whenever that icon is there, that means that that layer is visible. So you can uncheck a layer, and that layer will disappear from the image that you are looking at. So right now, we're only looking at one layer. That's the new layer I created that I painted all those red pixels on, and that's all you see. By the way, this sort of checkerboard pattern, this gray-white pattern, this means in Photoshop that they are transparent pixels. So whenever you see this, this means that these pixels are meant to be transparent, and if you put any layers underneath them, any images beneath them, you will see those pixels underneath that. And that's precisely what we saw when I had the background, was that it filled in those transparent pixels with what was there. And again, this holds true with this idea of a transparency. It's really as though I had this transparency that I laid on top of the image and I just painted some red pixels on top of it. And I could remove either the image underneath the transparency, I could remove the transparency itself, and you can see the original photo, or you can see just the edits that you've made to that layer specifically. Now you'll notice that one of the neat things is that you can change what's called the mode of a layer, and we'll look at this in just a moment. But different modes will do different things depending on the context of the colors, and it's basically telling Photoshop how to treat the layer. And a lot of these you most likely will never use, but a lot of them are actually pretty useful, as I'll show you in just a minute. But right next to this mode is this opacity, where you can actually make a layer less opaque, like we did before, for a specific. But whereas we modified the opacity for a specific tool, in this case we can do it for an entire layer. So we can just give the hint of something on top of something else by using a layer like this. Now, let's see. There's also, back down here, some more options for modifying layers as well. Like you can use the trash icon to delete a layer if you don't want it anymore. You can actually, if you have a whole bunch of layers in a photo, you can organize them into folders. So you can create a folder, give that folder a name, and then you can drag a set of layers into that folder. And again, all of these, what matters most in layers is which one is on top of the other. So if I were to move if I were to create a new layer, for example, and instead color this blue instead of red, so I'll go with that won't show up very well. I'll do green instead of red, and I can paint that here. You'll notice that depending on the order of the layers, I can have the green appear on top of the red, or if I change the order, I will have the red appear on top of the green. To make this more obvious, I should increase the opacity again. So now we can see that these are actual layers from bottom up. So right now the background is the image, then on top of that we have a green layer, then on top of that we have the red layer. And I can change the order of those just by dragging the layer order as shown in the layer palette. Yes? Yeah, there's a million ways to accomplish pasting somebody's head on top of a dog, but that is certainly one of them. And that would be to use, to reiterate for the camera, you could use the lasso tool to select the person's face in the original photo. Then you could copy those pixels, paste them into a new layer on top of the photo that has the dog, and then you could use the move tool to move the face into the proper position, and then you might even use the transform. Free transform tool, which is here. Free transform allows you to stretch or shrink individual layers. So if I do free transform, notice that. It's very important, by the way, to always know what layer you have selected, because whatever modifications you are making will generally be made only on that layer. So when I selected free transform, for example, notice that layer 2 was selected, and what is there then highlighted is that red portion, the red portion, which is represented by that green part. So I can make this a little bit bigger, for example, by stretching it this way. I could rotate it, just like what we saw for the crop tool, effectively. But I can do this for an entire layer. When I hit enter, then those changes are saved using this free transform tool. Now, to prove why it's important, to prove the fact that it's important to always remember which layer you're in, assume you have the brush tool selected. If you accidentally have your background layer selected and you make modifications to it, you are destructively editing the background. These green pixels are not on any new layer. They are, in fact, on the background layer, and I can prove that by getting rid of these other two layers here. Get done, gone, and gone. You notice that I've actually modified the pixels on this image, and generally, I mean, you might want to do this, but generally this is not what you want to do. Generally, you want to non-destructively edit your images, so be careful which layer you have selected when performing modifications to it. All right, so to digress back to this, the tools that are down here, you can use the folder again to organize some of them. You'll notice that you have like some special effects that you can apply on specific types of layers. This one, which is this one that is down in the corner that looks like a little square with a circle, this is called a layer mask. And this is actually really useful. We'll talk about this, in a second, so on and so forth. This last one is the, you can perform some changes to, or you can add some neat little effects to the layer itself. So, for example, if I wanted to change the levels, then I could change the levels here. Now, So with this, all right. So with all of these tools in mind, it's important to realize, it's important to remember the concept of layers, that you can have one layer on top of another. It essentially acts as a transparency on top of another photo. And you can actually completely block out the an underlying layer if one of your higher layers, has all opaque pixels, because then obviously you're not going to be able to see any pixels underneath it, and that you should be careful with that. So now one of the neat things about Photoshop is that you can actually have one of these layers that is completely opaque, and you can apply what's called a mask to it so that you can only selectively show certain pixels instead of others. So if I go back to the original configuration of this image, notice that this is now what the image originally looked like when I opened it. And the difference, and I'll show you the difference just by clicking this a couple times, is that in this composite image, there's just a lot more lights that exist in the image. So there's one that looks like this, one that looks like that. And this is actually just done using layers. It's not done using any sort of fancy copy-paste trickery or anything like that. It uses some of these special properties of layers to achieve this. So if I look at just this photo, or if I look at just this layer, you'll notice that it looks like this. And you see that there is essentially some transparent pixels along the top, and that this image differs slightly, or it's different slightly from the original image. So if I look at the original image, we can see that there are lights all the way on the far right over here. But if I look back at this other image, so this was another image that I had taken a little bit later, we notice that the lights are in a slightly different configuration. Really, what happened here was that I was sitting on an overpass with a tripod, and I took several photos, one in successive order, and this pass, this is Raton Pass in, on the border of New Mexico and Colorado, there's not a lot of traffic at this time on the pass. And the photos by themselves were not really terrifically exciting. Like there were some, you know, there's some lights, and occasionally you would get lucky and be able and capture lights coming in both directions, but really there was not the quantity of lights that I thought were that I thought would make this photo a little bit more interesting. So what I did was I took this photo and I put this photo as a layer on top of the other one. So this photo is now a layer on top, and normally what would happen is that it would completely mask the photo underneath. So let's see. Oops. All right, so normally this is what it would look like. Is this. So I have this. This is the original layer. And then when I paste, I copied this other image that I wanted to use in combination. I wanted to create a composite of these two images. So I copy the pixels from this other image and I paste it on top. It pastes it as a new layer, and it now looks like this. Notice that this is different than what we saw before. It's not actually compositing them both. You can actually see that they're two unique images. Right, because the configuration of the lights are changing and the clouds have moved slightly between the two. Now, using this mode property, I decided that one of the best ways to composite this image, and this was sort of a property of this, is that what differentiates the two is the brightness. There are areas of this image that are brighter than the others, and the rest of the pixels are pretty much the same. So these darker pixels don't really change that much, because the road hasn't moved. It's sitting on a tripod, so the pixels are all the same in the road and in this in the area over here to the left. So if I change the mode from normal to lighten, what this means is that it will take all of the pixels in this layer that are lighter than the pixels underneath and any layers underneath, and it will use the lightest pixels. So in essence, it looks at all of the layers and it takes the lightest pixels. So since I have just a few portions that are brighter than the rest, then I figure that this would be an ideal way of compositing these two images. Now, if I wanted to do something like, to go back to this example, pasting somebody's face on top on a dog, you probably wouldn't use this lighter mode, just because most likely the dog will have, you know, some bright pixels on him, and the face will have some bright pixels, and mixing the two is not going to work out like what you want, so you have to experiment with some of these different modes to see if you can get an effect that you want. Now, we're not quite done with this image, though, and the reason for that is you'll notice that the clouds, they don't look as interesting, and in fact, they look a little bit strange now, because there are portions of the clouds that are lighter in one image than in the next. And so this image The original image actually has more clouds in it, which is potentially more interesting, whereas this lighter image, or this image that is on top, seems to have, the clouds have seemed to move, have moved away from it, and so we don't get to see them quite as well. So the solution to this is to use a mask. Now, a mask is another important concept in Photoshop that allows you to modify a layer and specify non-destructively to Photoshop which pixels to actually use within that layer. So you'll notice that right next to this layer, do I see this, do I have that little chain again? And then there's this white box, it's filled with all white pixels. That is a mask. This box with white pixels represents a mask for this layer. Now I can modify this mask. If I add, anywhere that I add black pixels, that portion, the corresponding portion in the original image will be ignored. So right now you'll notice that I have the mask selected. I can select either the image itself, the layer itself rather, or the mask. And again, it's important to keep in mind which one you have selected, as you will be making modifications in one or the other. So if I have the mask selected, I can use the brush tool again, and I can set the foreground color to black, and I can start painting a mask. And you'll notice what happens is that it's as if we are getting rid of the pixels that are on top. So you see, as I'm making modifications, we start to see the pixels of the image that were underneath. So you can even see there's where the brush has extended out a little bit because the sky in the photo underneath is a little bit darker than the one on front. And we can see what happens as I start deleting these pixels. So if I look at the mask itself, and you can do that, notice that right now I have the mask selected and we don't actually see the mask itself, but we can see that there's a little bit of black right there, a bit of black splotchiness that I had added to this mask. You can select and view the mask itself by hitting the Option key and clicking on the mask. And then you will see the actual mask itself. So this is the mask that is used to create some transparent pixels in this image. So again, black means those pixels would become transparent in this layer. You will begin to see the pixels underneath that layer in any portion of this that is black. So if I, let's see, if I actually paste the original mask that I had created for this, you'll notice that this mask now follows actually very closely the horizon of the image itself. So just by using the brush tool, did I carefully mask out everything in this photo that is above the horizon. So what we see is the photo of the what we see is the sky of the photo underneath, and we are adding in, we are compositing in the lights of the photo on top using this lighten mode. Yeah, there was a question back there.
Is this a layer specifically designed to be a mask, or you just create a layer and start painting the black and Photoshop knows that you're looking for a mask?
Right, so creating a mask, any layer can have a mask associated with it. So if we go back to my ugly green layer here, I can actually, if I have a layer selected, recall that there was that mask button at the very bottom of the layers palette. If I click that button, that layer now gains a mask. And you'll notice that whereas before the layer looked like this, notice here, let me declutter this a little bit. Drag, delete this, and I'll delete this layer. So notice that the layer that I was talking about, this layer one layer at the very top, you can see that it has a mask because it has the chain and then the mask right next to it. Layer three does not have a mask associated with it, but I can provide it one by selecting that layer, clicking the add layer mask, and you'll notice that now I actually have a mask associated with this. So I can now use the paintbrush tool to mask portions of this layer out. Yes?
Can I make layer 3 the mask for another layer?
Can you do what? I'm sorry?
Can I make layer 3 the mask for another layer?
Can you make layer 3 the mask for another layer? Yes and no. Not directly. You can't do it directly, but what you can do is copy the pixels from layer 3. So I could go to, let's see, I usually do it with the keyboard, oh no, select all, and then I could go to copy, and then I could go to, I could select my layer mask, and I could just paste in that portion. You'll see that now we have pasted in this layer mask, or we have pasted in the pixels from layer 3 into this other mask, and we can move this this mask around as appropriate, and it will modify the image in that appropriate way. Okay. Any other questions about this? Yes? So the reason that you use black in the mask is because that represents a value of zero. What the mask is doing is that everywhere that there's a value of zero, you'll have that the pixels underneath shine completely through. Because that is saying that at this pixel right here, where that the mouse is pointing, this layer has no representation. So everywhere that it's white, that means that this is a value of 255. So this pixel right here, because it's 255, that means that this layer at this pixel has full representation. And in fact, you're not limited to just black and white. If you make a very, very, if you use a brush that is very, very soft, for example, you'll notice that you actually get this sort of gray intermediate as well, which is, in fact, it is that. It's a partial transparency. It's not completely opaque as it would be if it was white. It's not completely transparent as it would be if it was black. It's this partial transparency depending on the severity of the gray. So the more black it is, the more presence that one pixel will have versus the underlying pixels will have presence against the higher ones. But yes, it is a good question, but it is just using that trick of zero being black and 255 being white, and that's how it's doing this computation. Okay, so very quickly I'll show you one more mask. So one of these things you'll notice is that, I don't know if you've looked around on my Flickr account, but one of the images that I had there was I decided that it would be funny to take some photos that were the default Mac OS X wallpapers and some photos of my own and add a Simpsons character to them, the Simpsons character known as Ralph. And so I did that using a variety of techniques. One of them is masks. So this is an image from my hometown, El Paso, and actually just adding in, using some masks, I was able to add in Ralph as well. You'll notice that there are some layers here. We can see that there's a layer representing Ralph, this layer right here, and there's also a layer on top of him, which basically just gives him this appearance of suit, which is just like because he's standing in the smokestack. And this layer was made using a different, you'll notice that it uses a different mode, hard light, and it also uses a mask here to apply this suit only to the Ralph layer underneath, and the total combination of which is we're able to add in this character to this one image without having made any destructive modifications to the image underneath. And the other benefit to not destructively editing this is that you can then make changes to the mask, you can make changes to individual layers, and make it very easy. So just an example, I could move Ralph around just by clicking on the Move tool, selecting his layer, and I can actually just move him somewhere else. And this is one of the benefits of having non-destructive editing, is that I could move him, say, down here instead of to the top of the smokestack itself. Okay. I know it's a lot. There's a lot of stuff to do, but if you go to one of the lab machines here at Harvard, you'll be able to work with Photoshop and get a little bit of experience with masking and get a little bit more comfortable with its layout and using some of these tools. But I'm going to be honest with you, you're not going to know everything there is to know about Photoshop. People devote years of their lives to becoming Photoshop masters, and unless you do the same, don't feel bad that you don't know everything about it. I certainly don't. But hopefully we've started scratching the surface, and you can now start doing some fun modifications. And so with that, I hope you all go ahead and try that. And best of luck with this next problem set. We'll see you next week.